I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
This is Bill Buebert. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. This is episode 054, CG Excursions. The American military empire is in terminal collapse. So I have a variety of things to talk to you about today. A bit under the weather, but nonetheless, we are going to move forward. A bit of housekeeping, as always. Yes, I am reading considerably, as I always am. I wish I could come close to the standard that Daryl of Martyrmaid has set forth, but I'm not there yet. Nonetheless, I'm reading from my former friend and colleague, Lieutenant General Dan Bulger, his book, Why We Lost, which is a very detailed and forensic investigation of the clusterfuck that was the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the greater Middle East, starting in the 90s and 2000s. So I've been doing a fair amount of reading, but not as much as usual because I just came off vacation. My wife and I celebrated 3 decades together in holy matrimony. I like to call it 210 years because I like to extend the ecstasy in dog years, as it were. So a salute to my beautiful bride, if I may, on this episode, having just returned from our lovely vacation in Croatia. Croatia is a part of the former Yugoslavia, and the former Yugoslavia, of course, was part of the Ottoman Habsburg Empire back in the day, in the 19th and 20th century, and going further back, it's quite the storied area, as it were. And Croatia, if you take a look on a map, it is a sliver that is just across the Adriatic, the lovely Adriatic, from Italy proper, going up into the north, and then extending quite a bit from that narrow coastal peninsular mapping into a broader mountainous region in the northeastern portions of the country. Croatians fought a civil war, as it were, and I may cover that in a future episode because it was a civil war that was fought not only by Croatians from 91 to 95 and for others beyond 1995, but that just so happens to be the time when the Croatians got their independence again from the Yugoslavian imperators and overlords who had broke away under Tito from Soviet communist rule to create their own unique Marxian nuthouse in Yugoslavia. Now, of course, resident to Croatia, you have a whole lot of folks who really seem to be proud, I mean intensely proud, of their country. It is 95% Catholic. We didn't see a lot there that would reflect poorly upon them. I wouldn't call them beggared or poor, but they're certainly the stepchildren in the EU as far as funding is concerned. I heard tell the per capita income there is approximately 12 to 18K a year. That would not be reflected for tourists who are visiting there and staying at their lovely hotels and eating at their wonderful restaurants and driving on their first world U.S. highways, which are amazing because we put in 700 miles on a rental car, which I urge everybody to do when you visit a country if you have that capability. Get a rental car. Get to know the people that are around there. Wow, it was a great vacation. My wife, for the most part, planned it exquisitely from lodgings to where we would eat, where we would stay. I made some of the more technical arrangements concerning rental cars and things like that. So I loved it. It was wonderful. As a matter of fact, we stayed in Hvar for the here's the preamble. We flew into Split, which is at the southern portion. We drove up to Pula to meet senior son and his wife, who was on his way to a Bitcoin conference in Budapest, and spent 4 days with us, which was wonderful, in a VRBO that we rented up in Pula. And the Habsburg Empire, just so happened to have a naval fortress up there that appeared to be the crux and centerpiece of naval operations for them in the Adriatic, with associated fortresses and breastworks and things like that. Absolutely fascinating. So here you have the Ottoman Empire. Here you have the Habsburg Empire. Here you have the Venetian empires, the mercantilist empires that seep their way into a lot of what one would see as Croatian culture today, but is influenced greatly in the north by having both Italian and Croatian speakers. Speaking Croatian, by the way, is quite difficult. Not a Cyrillic language, not a Romantic language, but it's very difficult to apprehend, but we tried our best, especially my wife, who is very capable of learning new languages far more so than me. And I think that the residents of a country always take it as a compliment when you make the effort to try to learn the language that they speak and read on an everyday basis. As far as history is concerned, me being an amateur historian and a history geek, I go there and I find that on the so we're on the island of Hvar our last 5 days, and lovely resort, highly recommended. Anybody who wants to know about, well, how do I go to Croatia, which is referred to as the Florida of Europe because of its exquisite coastline, and in one of the Bond movies with Daniel Craig, where he gunned down with an MP5 Mr. White from one of the criminal organizations, I think that castle or building on the coastline there that had been shot in the Adriatic. Was it Italy? Was it Croatia? I'm not certain what it was. Fabulous coastline. Fabulous sea. I almost said ocean. You can't say ocean. We're referring to the Adriatic because some people will get their knickers up over that. But nonetheless, we stayed on the island of Hvar, which is referred to as one of the 10 most beautiful islands in the world to rival French Polynesia. Been there, done that. Kauai. Been there, done that. And some others. And yes, it is. It's astonishing, the beauty. And here's the coolest part about Hvar. But then again, this extends to Croatia as a whole, is that I'm on the island of Hvar, and they've had sophisticated. Remember when I said, I'm not talking Neolithic, I'm not talking cavemen, I'm not talking folks who go there with a civilizational structure that is significantly subpar. Sophisticated Greek Hellenic civilization has been on Hvar since 2500 BC. Now, I could be off by that. Could be 500 years more or less, but nonetheless, the wife and I, whether it was on Hvar or in Pula, or when we went to Zagreb, or when we went down south to Split yet again, we were treading on places where Roman boots had been, Roman hobnails had been, Greek merchants had been, Venetian royalty had been. Wars had been fought here back and forth in tides, and we even got to see Greek ruins that are still up, and Roman ruins, to include a Colosseum. I think it was the fifth or sixth largest Colosseum in the Roman Empire up in Pula that was incredibly well-preserved, which was another thing, too. We went to several museums there, and my wife made the point. She said, you know, if we were in America or someplace else like that, they'd have this stuff behind glass, behind plastic. They'd have cordons. They'd have security guards, stuff like that. None of that. One of these museums, which was just lovely, and they have this regime that they use for language where, because it is the European Union, and by the way, yes, I still loathe and despise the EU and the Brusselsians, but nonetheless, they've got British, which represents English language. They've got Italian, they've got German, they've got French, they've got Spanish. So when you're in these museums, the whole tapestry is there for you to read. All of these objects are there. You can actually lay hands on objects, some of which may have been laid hands on by Diocletian himself, because we did visit Diocletian's summer palace. He was one of the more execrable Roman emperors, but then again, weren't most of them. I think I can name on my hand 6 Roman emperors, all hail Aurelius and all hail Augustus, that were worth their salt. And by the way, as an aside, never put teenagers in charge with ultimate power. It always ends badly. Even you, Alexander, I'm looking at you, Alexander the Great. So we didn't have a bad meal there. The alcohol was amazing. The wine was amazing. I'm not so much a wine guy. I consider it to be, because of my Philistine tastes, it's vinegar and grape juice to me. My wife, though, much more of a connoisseur. Two of my children happen to be sommeliers. So they have a better acquaintance and knowledge about wine, but from what they were saying and talking to senior son and his wife there, quite pleasant. Whether it was white wine or red wine, we visited a variety of wineries while we were there. Those were some of the trips that we booked. We booked a private tour with a gentleman by the name of Dennis up in Pula who lived up there, and we got to go into the very community that he lived in. The man and his neighbors live in homes that date back 1,100 years. There are Roman architecture, Roman aqueducts, Roman ruins and such that could still provide formidable breastworks or the ability to use them as arterials, whatever the case may be. And as with a lot of European nations, and remember, this is sort of an Eastern European nation, bifurcated more so than Western Europe. When you get into these small towns, and we got to go into one of the towns that was sort of like the Truffles Nerve Center. I'm not fond of truffles. My wife is. Truffles are apparently a form of mushroom. Dennis on the tour took us on a truffle tour. We didn't go out into the woods to hunt them. They even have truffle dogs. But he went on to say, and I find the smell revolting, he went on to say that they found a 2 kilogram, and I'm paraphrasing here, a 2 kilogram truffle that fetched $380,000. 2 kilograms is a little over 4 pounds. Wow, that's an expensive mushroom. But then again, you could get a serviceable bottle of wine on the continent, and especially in Croatia, for $5, $6, $7. Now, mind you, prices throughout are by U.S. standards. As a matter of fact, it's sort of like when we took our trip to Costa Rica, we discovered, this is like U.S. prices. Same there. But the Croatian people are so gracious. It's a slow food culture. So there's no, we saw a couple of fast food places. As a matter of fact, we saw a huge KFC complex, and I thought, oh, isn't that novel? But we didn't go, of course. We tended to go to mom and pops and smaller places. Stayed in fabulous hotels, everything from the tallest building in Croatia in Split, which was the AC Marriott, 31 stories. And then from there, that's when we took our trip up to Pula to meet the children. And the highway system, as I mentioned, is amazing. And when you have to get fuel, by the way, fuel was approximately $1.50 in euro per liter, 3.8 liters in a gallon. I'm estimating that with dollars, you're looking at about $6.50 to $7 a gallon that we were paying for petrol while we were over there. Yes, two times as much as we would pay in the United States. Well worth it to have the ability to drive and meet folks. And by the way, when you stop at these exquisite gas stations that they have on their autobahns, you have to pay a euro to take a leak. I love that system. I love user fees, of course, more so than taxes. So it really made my heart sing to do that kind of thing. All in all, the music, the pride, 95% of the country is Catholic. They are so bloody proud of what they've made of themselves. One misfortune for them is that industry, they were famed shipbuilders for the longest time, and they could build other things. That stuff is starting to decay and die and go away, and they rely a lot for their GDP, apparently, on tourism, and they are the most gracious folks. So we went there. As you know, I've sort of been incommunicado for the past 3 weeks because that's while we were on vacation. As I mentioned, we started in Split, where we landed. We drove all the way up to Pula. Then we drove across to Zagreb for a short period of time. And then we came back through Pula and came back to Split, took a ferry over to Hvar, H-V-A-R. I urge all of my listeners and or readers to take a look at that on a map. It was so drop-dead gorgeous. Roman architecture, Greek architecture. A fortress was at the top of the hill, illuminated at night while we were dining at our very nice hotel. So the people were so gracious. And like I mentioned, they are so proud not only of being Croatians and not only of being rather homogenous in their culture, but I mentioned Dennis, who we spent 2 days with, fortunately, because we had booked tours and didn't know that we would have him for 2 days straight, and it was just great. And I urge everybody who visits a country to try to do the very same thing. He is very concerned about food. He's very concerned about food and drink. He, like so many Croatians that we met, he puts away 75 liters of olive oil from his olive trees. He makes his own wine. If he doesn't make the ale or the wine or the cheese or the truffles or the meat or the vegetables, there's a community market there. It's much like, for those of you who are familiar with Germany, you have these market plots, these centerpieces in a small town where people meet. And of course, coffee's a big thing there. And of course, I'm a non-smoker. My wife's a non-smoker. I'm not fond of cigarette smoking, and it is all over the place there. But then again, unlike the Australians who pay $45 a pack, I think that they pay like €4.50 a pack in Croatia. The reason I went to Croatia is because I just so happened to serve with a Croatian soldier and went outside the wire on occasion in northern Afghanistan with Croatian Special Forces organizations. Now, I find the Croatians were hard-bitten guys, tough guys. These were really, really talented soldiers. I'm not going to bore you with all the history, even though you know I would like to, with all the history about Croatia. But remember that Croatia had SS legions in World War II. They served the Habsburg Empire. They have always provided soldiery of one sort or another, and they have a very, I would say, particular nature in the way that they conduct their martial business, and I would not want to fight them. If one looks at the absolute brutality in the 1990s, where I served in Kosovo and Bosnia-Herzegovina, which are due east of Croatia proper, there was savagery there on a scale that I had never seen before, even in the Middle East. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, if you go here in peacetime and you visit, you are going to be rewarded with seeing a country that is drop-dead gorgeous. The people are so proud of who they are, who they've been, where they are. I got the sense from a lot of them that joining the EU and joining NATO, a lot of them, of course, this is a canvassing that is anecdotal, and of course it would be influenced by my own cynicism when I'm discussing it with them. They're not pleased with what's going on. They don't like the devil's bargain that they've entered into with Brussels and Belgium. So Croatia, 10 out of 10, highly recommend. Escape from Europe. We fly back to Frankfurt last Monday. And then what we discover is Hurricane Milton is barreling down on the coast on which I live, the Gulf Coast of Florida, and flights are delayed. We were supposed to be home by Tuesday evening. After much wrangling, we managed to get Lufthansa to rebook our flight, and we left for Miami instead of the Gulf Coast because they had closed the airports that we traditionally use in Tampa and south of Tampa. So that being the case, we arrived in Miami, rented a car, stayed overnight, did our laundry because our power was off, and then we got on the road on Wednesday. Well, our power goes off again, apparently, Wednesday evening. We arrive home Wednesday evening. Those of you familiar with the state of Florida, left Miami, which happens to be my birthplace, by the way, left Miami, mile marker 161 on 75 is when we started to see some of the damage, but I've got to tell you, we didn't see a lot of damage. Got back to our home. Thank goodness. Our home is intact. Windows are intact. Roof is good. No penetration or compromise of the structure itself. Everything in the house, all the things that you can imagine I love, like my very large library, are in great shape. But our fencing, our gardens, wrecked. Lots of work. We got a significant amount of work done yesterday trying to tend to that. And then, of course, I have friends up in some of the epicenters from Sarasota to Tampa who have fared far worse than we did. So that being the case, we really we missed a nuclear bomb here, and I'm happy for that. When all the talk was out there just off the Mexican coast of what Milton was and what Milton was forming and turning into this Category 5 storm and what would happen to us once it hit, I live enough inland, we're about maybe a half hour minus from the beautiful beaches here on the Gulf Coast of Florida. It could have been so much worse, and it wasn't. Storm surges, wind damage, things like that. But as far as the home devastation that Ian brought down 2 years ago, it pretty much didn't match up to that, fortunately. And the nice thing about hurricanes, I'm a native Floridian, my wife is a native Floridian, is that we've weathered these things for a significant period of our early lives. And of course, when I lived in Okinawa, Japan, living with typhoons, that's what you did for a living down there. So we were expecting devastation, didn't get devastation. And I also enjoyed the fact that so many people are willing to stand up and say, I am Spartacus, and help out their neighbors, help out their friends, help out their family. And then on the saddest note for this, what was an entirely successful trip overseas, except for the bump of getting home, and then discovering that our house wasn't damaged, even though we've got some work to do, is my beloved cat, Stitch, who I've had since 2016, has gone on to his reward because of medical issues that he had. And that happened to me in Europe. It has left a hole in my heart because he and I were best buddies. And I'm sad about that. But nonetheless, we'll survive. Thanks for indulging that housekeeping in that preamble, but I wanted to keep my listeners up to date. And since I am feeling under the weather, I wasn't able to do the requisite and usual mountain of research I do for these episodes. So this one is going to be something of a Jack Kerouac episode. It is going to be something of stream of consciousness. Because one thing that has struck me over the past decades, the quarter century that I served in uniform, the time that I spent after that adjacent to the military-industrial complex, and seeing America's wars since 1979 when I started paying attention to them professionally, and I'm seeing nothing more than this kind of entropic and fragility collapse of the entire defense establishment in the U.S. and its allied nations in NATO. So I wanted to do something of a stratospheric reflection, holistically, of what the hell's going on with all of this. We're at a pretty precipitous time in the nation's history right now. I know that we hear again and again and again, and I know you're going to hear me, a non-voter, saying this, but they say, this is the most important election of your lifetime. Every 4 years, they tell you the same thing. This is a very significant fork in the road. I don't know what's going to happen. As most of you could intimate, and as some of you who correspond with me know, I feel as if the domestic color revolutions that occurred in the United States in 2020 and 2022, and the voter election integrity issues that have yet to be resolved, because of that, I don't see how Trump could get in office. Now, again, I am not a champion of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. I consider them the uniparty, the stupid party, two left wings of the predatory deep state. Nonetheless, there is a departure here, because if things keep going the way they are in the DOD, with the present administration's velocity forward, then the collapse that I am forecasting for the entirety of the U.S. military combine is going to come sooner than later. If the GOP were to get into office, what would that do for us? I'm frankly not certain. I'm frankly skeptical that the ship can be steered in a direction in which it does not founder upon the shoals of imperial hubris. But we'll see what happens. My pet theory is, after seeing what Calvin Coolidge accomplished as one of the only presidents that I admire in the entire pantheon of presidents in U.S. history, is that in March 1933, at FDR's inauguration, the deep state reached capital S singularity and has been in charge ever since. One will notice, and this isn't conspiracy, this is fact, that between 1952 and 2008, whenever the Republicans were in the awful office, that there was always a deep state apparatchik there by the name of Nixon or Bush to make sure that the deep state's agenda wasn't veered away from. Then you had the two terms of Barack Obama afterwards, in which we saw not only the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars expanded, despite promises made by the war party, in this case, the Democrat Party, to not do so, but also remember the Democrats were the authors of World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Haiti, Somalia, Serbia, on and on. And then, of course, in the 21st century, we have Barack Obama during his time, and I'm not neglecting that Bush's son got us into the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq as a result of machinations in 9-1-1, but he maintains and surges the war footing in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also creates new conflicts in Libya, in Syria, in the Horn of Africa. As a matter of fact, in 2016, in his last year in office, I think he dropped several dozen thousand precision-guided munitions in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So what we find there is, despite the fact that they like to parade themselves as the peace party, they're not. Neither party is the peace party. They're both imperial parties, because 1791, I think there's been a dozen years of peace in which the U.S. wasn't involved in blooding itself somewhere, either during its genocide against Aboriginal Americans up until the end of the 19th century, or its first imperial marches in Mexico and Hawaii in the late 19th century, accelerating into other imperial enterprises well throughout the 20th century. A militarist nation, a nation at war, a nation that fought World War I, World War II, what I like to refer to as the war to save Joseph Stalin. And what you find again and again is that war is the health of the state, as Randolph Bourne would tell us, and that appears to be the case now. One thing that has surprised me so much with the special military operation by Russia into Ukraine over 2 years ago is that the peace process is dead. I would think that the U.S., the British, the Allies, NATO would be concerned about having a peace table available. I've always thought the moment a conflict like that occurs, then the Department of State, as useless as they are and as cynically bad as they are, would open a very expensive office suite in Geneva, Switzerland, and have very expensive tables, refreshments, chairs, and such available for folks to come in and talk and try to, paraphrasing Churchill, jaw, jaw instead of war, war. But I have been so just disappointed in the entire peace approach. People say, well, that's a form of appeasement. But nonetheless, William Burns, the CIA director now in this administration, when he was the ambassador to Russia in 2008, wrote back a cable that said in detail, and I've talked about this in previous episodes, that the red line for Russia would be the Ukraine. That if America were to get involved, or NATO were to get involved in this, it would just be a bloody mess that would escalate to the point of, between nuclear nations, things could happen that cause triggers to nuclear weapons to be used, and then we all know what happens after that. Maybe we don't specifically know. Maybe I'll tell you, we don't want to know. So on a cadence of about 4 to 5 times a week, and over my vacation it was 3 times a week, over at the Libertarian Institute, where I am the Samuel D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs, I blog on the current state of U.S. allied and NATO military mismanagement, problems they're having with the acquisition of systems, and just the overall bureaucratic temper of a military system on its last legs. It's not merely due to IED. It's not merely due to $700 toilets. It's not merely due to an acquisition systems that would make the Soviets blush. It's not nearly due to the incompetence that seems to marinate and saturate vertically and horizontally throughout the entirety of the DOD and the Pentagon, nor, maybe, demonstrably, the fact that the U.S. hasn't won a conflict since 1945. For those of you who are new listeners who will instantly pop up, especially if you are astute contemporary observers and historians, and you'll say, but Bill, what about Iraq in 1991? What happened there? Didn't we win it? Well, if we won it, why'd we go back in 2003? Because we didn't win it, and we didn't do the right thing at the time. Over there, I think forensically, I brought the hand receipts, the footnotes, and the index cards to show you why, in detail, these failures are manifest everywhere. For those of you who have listened since the beginning of this podcast series, over 2 years ago, I can't believe it, I started this over 2 years ago. But nonetheless, if you've paid attention, I have this notion that I think that fragility and anti-fragility are a big part of warfare now. I also think that revolutions and military affairs are afoot. Per fragility and anti-fragility. The whole notion of this podcast, even though we're going a little bit outside of our bounds and barriers right now, covering both irregular warfare and regular warfare in this particular episode, I think it still applies in that fragility would be a system that could be shattered, sundered, or rendered harmless or ineffective by certain things simply not happening. It wouldn't have the means to dynamically respond, reconfigure itself, and then move on to success, whereas anti-fragile forces tend to do that. And what you find historically and contemporaneously is that all insurgencies planet-wide tend to be rather anti-fragile enterprises that even have almost a mathematical relationship to the amount of time that the invading fragile forces are there and adapting to what they do and integrating new TTP and these kind of things. For instance, in the West, what we've done for the longest time is America, and of course, this is from a memory hole because America no longer sustains this kind of technological footing or advancement or improvement cycle that we did prior to the 21st century. So for longtime listeners, thank you, by the way, for your solicitude, and you know I've covered a lot of these things in detail, for instance, like what I'm going to cover right now, which is that if I look at this from the joint perspective, and the joint perspective in this case is a capital J joint, and this has nothing to do with Bob Marley, this has to do with how does the Air Force and the Army and the Marines and the Navy, maybe even the Coast Guard, integrate themselves into an effective fighting force that is more than the sum of its parts. Hence, joint planning, joint strikes, joint operations, those kind of things. From that perspective, one of the things that you must do to be effective on the conventional battlefield, which hasn't been fought for a very long time by the United States, in fact, one could call that 1991, as the U.S. entry for that 2 weeks in which they were able to actually practice it, but they practiced it against a foe who was regarded left of bang as the fourth largest army on planet Earth, but folded in 2 weeks under superior implementation of operational planning, operational employment, and great technology at the time in that snapshot of 1991. Now we fast forward 30 years and we find that the Russians say, enough is enough. We are not pleased with what's been happening in the Eastern Donbass to Russians and Russian-affiliated citizens who happen to still remain in the Ukraine. So we are going to do what we can do to stop that kind of madness emanating from Kiev. And the special military operation was inaugurated. And those hostilities now have been going on for everybody to see. And what you will note is that, and I talked about this in an episode 48, CG Excursion, Pier Strike, ISR Complex, The Needs for Rational Fires Coordination, where I talked about the superiority of the Russians having broken the code of fire synchronization for sensors and effectors. In this case, sensors would be radars, effectors would be artillery. And as I emphasized in that episode, I want everybody to wrap their heads around the fact that this isn't World War II artillery when I use that term in Argo. What artillery means here is that any munition that is fired from a plane, any munition that is fired from the ground, maybe it impacts something in the air, maybe it impacts something in a parabola on the other side behind a reverse military slope or enfilade or defilade or a bunker buster, whatever the case may be. The Russian army in 2008 set out to make itself new, to make itself 21st century relevant, and to take what the Red Army had done in the 20th century and update it. And in essence, have time on target with metal on target within 10 to 60 seconds, depending on the operational or tactical depth of the employment for that coordination. What we've seen, for those of you who are paying attention, of Russia and the Ukraine, is they broke the code on that. Here's the bad news for you, though, and this again is from a joint perspective, and it's even worse at an allied perspective when you have the joint U.S. forces interacting and synchronizing with NATO forces on said battlefield with all the language barriers, the communications interoperability problems, and all the rest of it, is that America is not prepared to synchronize its fires in an effective fashion at the tactical or operational level. Another Argo we employed is deliberate and hasty. Deliberate means, well, these are the targets that we've located. These are the ones we are going to service, and you service those. That could be done in a serviceable fashion, but not an exquisite fashion. But nonetheless, when it comes to hasty, it's a bloody mess. Because for the past quarter century, in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, Libya, Syria, and all the rest, we have had outstanding fires coordination, for instance, with A-10s and ground troops, whether those are forward air controllers or those magnificent Air Force CTTs who are the most powerful warriors as single men in the history of mankind, who can bring the hate from 52s to 16s, to whatever kind of ordnance you can imagine that they can carry, to AC-130 uniform gun trucks, whatever the case may be, they can do it. Well, we don't have that synchronization possibility at the Corps level, at the Army level, at the divisional level. As a matter of fact, the Army has been rather silly in the way they've approached the division, because it seems like every 4 or 5 or 6 years, they come up with a new reason to say, yeah, we're going to have floating divisional structures. Yeah, we're going to have brigade combat teams. Now, I am very fond of force and task organizations like BCTs, Brigade Task Force, and things like that, because what they're doing is they're taking these and they're saying, we are going to tailor make purpose-built forces designed for the fight at hand, and we'll have the ability, sort of like Legos, to put that together, make it happen, project power forward, in a 24, 48, 72-hour period of time, with safe haven and sufficient auxiliary and logistics, one could achieve success in a hot war, although I don't see that happening, whether that war is against the Russians or against the Koreans on the Korean Peninsula or wherever that new war that no one has planned for, even though, as I've told you guys before, everybody who starts a war thinks it'll be over in a week. But if they read any history books, they would really know better. But we're not ready. We don't have the fire synchronization complex. They're still trying to do the air battle management business with ABMS. JADC2, the Joint All Domain Command and Control, the DOD project that they've had in place forever. And again and again, none of this is coming to the fore, in which if there is a conventional toe-to-toe hot fight like this near peer and peer engagement that you're seeing between the Russians and the Ukrainians, the U.S. and especially its NATO midget allies will fail in a glorious fashion. So I've talked about the Army. The Army, of course, thinks that the revolution in military affairs that we have discovered since Nagorno-Karabakh in the fall of 2020, which dictates that robots and UAVs and deception, of course, that's thousands of years old, are going to take on a vision of the battlefield that no one has experienced before. As a matter of fact, I would tell you, and of course I've talked about this in previous episodes, I would tell you this revolution in military affairs is going to be a singleton revolution too. What it means is that, as a former infantryman myself, 11 Bravo in the Army, 0311 in the Marines, for the first time in the history of mankind, it has become cheaper in salvo competition if you have sufficient mass and deployment of, let's say, small UASs and things like that, that they can be expended to take down individual soldiers in a squad or entire squads and platoons simply with UAVs. The UAVs will be operating, let's say, they could disperse munitions, or kamikaze style, they could crash into a truck, into a fighting position, or into the open hatch of a tank. You will be aware that my prediction, my forecast, I hate that word prediction. Prediction demands too much of an evidentiary bar when it comes to this complex, adaptive framework we have in modern warfare. I don't have to use the word modern. Any warfare. You're going to have fog. You're going to have friction. You're going to have Murphy, who's in charge. Murphy is a king of battle, not artillery, not infantry. It's Murphy's Law. Something will go awry. Something will go wrong. So we're witnessing with UAS, with robotics, with autonomous targeting, with hypersonic munitions, and I've covered all of this stuff in more detail and depth in previous episodes that you can find on your podcast provider and see if there's anything of interest there. Like I've said before about my undertaking here at Chasing Ghosts, this is not a critical path podcast in which you have to listen to every episode from episode one. But what I do think you'll find helpful is that if I mention something in this episode that happens to be offered in greater detail in a previous one, look at my episode list. Here we're on episode 54. Look at my episode list. You'll probably find something there, which I'll dig deeper and provide you with more information that you need to come to better conclusions, to come to what I so fondly call the single most accurate picture of what reality looks like right here, right now. The Air Force is fielding the F-35 Alpha Bravo Charlie, the Bravo Charlie being the VTOL, STOL variants for the Marine Corps and the Navy, being adopted by other Marines and naval forces around the world, not the quantities that you need because, and again, you can either look on my podcast or on my blog, in which I've covered this extensively and provided all the evidence and footnotes that you need, because I'm the guy who reads the Congressional Research Service reports and the GAO reports, so you don't have to do it yourself. Take a guess, if I haven't mentioned before, although I suspect that I have, is that when it comes to the Bravo Charlie variants, the STOL veto variants of the F-35, which I think is just a crushingly stupid and ineffective weapon system that is amazingly expensive, their readiness rate right now, and this comes straight, I'm paraphrasing a bit, from the Air Force Secretary's mouth, is at less than 30%, which means that if you have three birds on the ground, only one bird can probably leave the ground at that time, and that is starting to diminish over time. As a matter of fact, every F-35 produced between 2008 and 2012 found itself at zero operational readiness ratings. The Air Force sort of took the F-22. I think that because of the arcane way that software upgrades work, if you miss two or more of them, and people are far smarter about this than I am, you've almost bricked or blocked the aircraft. That has happened. As a matter of fact, there are a number of F-22s that have been bricked and blocked for that very same reason out at the Boneyard in Tucson, Arizona, where the AMARG is. And you can look that up and you will find that, yea and verily, because I consider the F-22 a triumph, probably one of the best aircraft since the Vietnam War that America has developed. The F-16, extraordinary, and we could go back in history, but that is not the temper of this particular episode. But nonetheless, the F-35 is a disaster. And we have the Bone, which is the B-1B, And we're lucky, if I recall, and of course, one can go to my blog, and I've got the exact numbers there. I think there's 50 in service that are serviceable as far as OR rates are concerned. The B-2 is going away. It's going to be replaced by another $2 billion aircraft again. I cover that on my blog, and I won't bore you with that here today. The Air Force, when it comes to acquisitions, when it comes to exquisite platforms, and by the way, I want you to burn that phrase into your brain, exquisite platforms, because 21st century warfare is not going to be about exquisite platforms. It's going to be about leakers. And what that means from a salvo competition perspective is that I will send as many missiles aloft as I want to target your carrier, to target your refuelers, to target your refueling bases, to target your troops, whatever the case may be. And you can knock 90% of them down, but that means 10% of them will meet their targets. And that is a disaster for exquisite platforms. As you know, several months ago, it might have been 8 months ago, when I heard that they were sending M1 Abrams, and of course those were follow-ons to Leopards and Challengers that were given to the Ukrainians, they sent those tanks forward. I said that any of those that go into the eastern third of the Ukraine, well, they're going to be turned into scrap. Of the 31 M1 Abrams, it appears that 20 have been turned into scrap. Several of those have been turned into scrap by $50,000 UASs that either kamikaze or deliver gift baskets to the open hatches of these vehicles on the battlefield. Did I mention the Air Force disaster of upgrading the Minuteman 1, 2, and 3, which until 2 years ago used 8-inch floppy drives for some of their command and control issues that they were having? Did I mention, for instance, that the Sentinel with which they want to replace is way behind, was supposed to have its first operational launch success 2 years ago? It has been shifted 2 years to the right from now for that very thing to happen, and that I don't know if the sclerotic, arthritic, and ancient Minuteman system has a surety as far as the two components that are so important. Those two components would be, will the warhead do what it has to do once it reaches its target? And number two, will the booster platform be able to perform all of its functions to get that aloft so that at its apogee, it can release and send those weapons wherever they have to be delivered? We don't know. As Elon Musk would tell you, and I'm paraphrasing, rocketry and building a rocket that reaches low Earth orbit is one of the most sophisticated and problematic and hardest engineering efforts that human beings have ever taken on. And we're expecting these long loiter dormant missiles and the three legs of the triad, that would be SLBM, submarine launch ballistic missiles. That would be ELICMS, which would be the airborne cruise missile launches. And then, of course, you would have the Minutemans that I just mentioned that are going to be replaced by the Sentinel. By the way, I provide all the hand receipts and the details on why these programs are failing in such a big way. Air Force, again, for incoming, what do we have for mid-course interception of IRBMs and ICBMs, intermediate-range ballistic missiles and intercontinental ballistic missiles, which, by the way, have been hypervelocity munitions since the 1950s. The Air Force can loft a total of 44 missile interceptors. 44. Count them. 44. Now, if you know anything about probability of kill, and I won't bore you with all of the mathematics and statistics behind it, what it means is that whether you're doing shoot, look, shoot, or shoot, shoot, look, which is you fire, look, and a dynamically retask, or you fire, look, and then maybe dynamically retask, is that probability kill dictates in most of these kind of engagements, especially when it comes to the interception of hypervelocity munitions, that what you must do is send more than one aloft. In this case, ideally, against an IRBM and ICBM, you're going to need 2 to 4 to achieve, 4 would be the top, to achieve that 92% probability of kill. Because I think on the other end of the scale, sending up one, you have maybe a 40% minus probability of kill, which means that of those 44, 11 targets could be lofted against and probably serviced. But who knows if they would be or not. Somebody's not doing the math properly. Now we move on to the Marine Corps. And we see on the under the Marine Corps with Berger, who was probably the one of the worst commandants to ever serve as the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps since its inception in the 18th century, has managed not only to remove tanks, which I think was a fair thing to do, remove artillery, but turn the Marine Corps not into a global 911 response force that had Marine-ready groups stationed in whatever numbers they may be at battalion or brigade strength or regimental strength, waiting for things to go awry or to go wrong. He's taken all his eggs, put them in the basket of the Pacific, and he said, we're going to do shoot and scoot, where we're going to have these kind of missile munitions on the second and third island chains. I'm going to take the entire Marine Corps mission. I'm going to dedicate it to doing this so that they will shoot and then they will move and then they will shoot and they, on the islands. Well, there's a lot of problems with the concept of operations and the concepts of employment for that. I'll bring two to your attention, but there's a lot more out there because there was a very large dissident group of active duty and retired Marine Corps officers and NCOs who joined in and said, wait, stop. You're taking this very exclusive, I would have said amphibious force, but there is no amphibious capability to the Marines anymore, especially when it comes to contested beaches. That was done in Incheon in 1950 and hasn't been done since then. There are no surface maritime connectors that can do that against a contested beach, which is why they adopted helicopter landings via vertical envelopment to get the Marines on shore, things like that. So I don't even know if they could do that, but they're certainly not doing what they've done historically when it comes to being that 911 force. There were two recent incidents in Africa in which the special operations organizations and Europe had to respond because the Marines weren't available. Now, the Marines have a lot going for them as far as their capabilities. No one comes close to their esprit. No one comes close to their C2 and interoperability in which they habitually work together through all dimensions of the battlefield. So that would be ship, shore, artillery, soldiers on the ground, soldiers in urban areas, in not urban areas, places like that. So my two main questions to the commandant are, number one, and no one's answered this for me, even though I think that there are a lot of smart guys out there who could, is number one, should you take the U.S. Marine Corps and devote it to a Pacific regional threat exclusively and not acquaint them, allow them, or fit them out for purpose to do other things outside of that theater? I think that's a foolish notion for a force to take on. Number two, what are you going to do about stealthily evacuating casualties? Notice I didn't talk about logistics. Notice I didn't talk about taking missiles and munitions and refits at squad, platoon, company, maybe even battalion strength, even though you would be suicidal to put a battalion strength Marine element on one of the second or third island chains if a hot war with China goes off. How are you going to get them out of there? Guess what? You can't. Not only do we not have the submarines to do it, but we don't have seaplanes to do that because the U.S. Navy nor the Coast Guard, no, I take that back, the Coast Guard does. The U.S. Navy does not have seaplanes. Guess who has seaplanes and guess who has the best seaplane on planet Earth? That would be Japan. It's right there. All we got to do is reflag it, buy it. We don't have to try to refit a C-130 to be a seaplane or anything like that. The Japanese make it. It's the US-1. It's awesome. Look it up. Incredible. But without that, you can't do casualty evacs. You can't do logistics refits. You can't do any of that on those second and third island chains. And by the way, how do you do that stealthily on an island chain? How do you move from island to island or from island to ship? How do you do that stealthily in when one looks at that second and third island chain because of the air defense and aerial denial surveillance panopticon that the Chinese have put in place there? How does anything move without the Chinese knowing that something has happened there? The quick answer is it doesn't. And now, finally, we go to the U.S. Navy and the carrier. Please stop building these things. The USS Ford, the latest instantiation of what I refer to as the crossbow and the chariot of the 21st century, the aircraft carrier, can't reliably launch or retrieve aircraft, and I can bore you with all the details in either the episode that you listened to concerning that, or my dispatch concerning that, or the many articles that I've written over at the Libertarian Institute blog where I've talked about that endlessly. You look at the little crappy ship. At the turn of the 20th century, the U.S. Navy said we need a littoral combat ship, a smaller ship that is modular, that can do anti-mine missions. It could do anti-submarine missions. It could do shore bombardment missions. It could do all these kind of things. Well, it can't do any of that. As a matter of fact, none of the modules have worked. And as another matter of fact, they're being retired 5 to 7 years into their 30-year service lives. Now, from Bill's opinion, what should have happened with the littoral combat ship is that that was the opportunity for the U.S. Navy to get its head out of its ass and say, you know what, diesel-electric submarines are a good idea, and when you look at the D variants that the Germans are building, maybe we can grab one of those, do some sea trials, see how it fits out. We can look at logistics and shipbuilding and opportunities for us, maybe let contracts, let them build them for us, and have a diesel-electric submarine fleet. Because guess what? Yes, the United States leads the earth when it comes to nuclear submarines, even though that's another problem because our shipbuilding throughput and our maintenance throughput has caused tremendous delays and dysfunction in the U.S. nuclear submarine force, where it means that of the total number of submarines that we have, you would be lucky, especially using rules of three, being able to deploy them in wartime at numbers of more than 50, most likely less than 50, in my estimation, most likely less than 30. We have had one ship, a Virginia class, that has been dockside for 7 years due to lack of maintenance throughput and the ability of people to do that. The U.S. Navy has also recently sort of either waylaid or mothballed, and I'm putting mothballed in air quotes because we don't quite know what they're doing, 17 maritime service force ships, which are auxiliary ships that are used. And of course, everybody who's been paying attention to what's going on in the Red Sea noted two things that the U.S. Navy said. Number one, they said, we saw the most violent, and I'm paraphrasing, the most violent and stressful naval combat since World War II in the Red Sea against a foe that didn't have a navy. And you also note that there are 17 oilers in that class of oiler that went down that was servicing the carrier fleet in the Red Sea. As a result of that oiler going aground and being mission ineffective, the carrier and its flotilla had to leave. I mentioned the LCS, I mentioned the Ford. Did I mention the Zumwalt? Zumwalt originally was going to be the new frigate, the new destroyer. Frigate and destroyer, there are very distinctive naval architecture delineations for that. The Navy, of course, is confused. Is the Zumwalt a destroyer? Is it a frigate? Is it a frigate plus? They don't bloody well know. Well, they had something called the Lurlap, which is a $1 million round on the Zumwalt. So expensive, they removed the gun. It doesn't have a gun. All it has is vertical launch systems, VLSs, which has been around for decades, and it's a way to deliver various munitions from SM missiles to Tomahawks and things like that that they would have on there. I read recently, I did not know this, when the Zumwalt was commissioned, I think, let's put it at 2014, 2015, I may have to correct that, it took them 5 years to fire their first missile. 5 years. That's unsatisfactory. What I'm saying here, in this brief coverage that I've given you of all of these disasters from the joint to the individual service component level, is this is all it's an aggregation of failure. It's a cascade avalanche of incompetence, lack of foresight, and the sheer inability to get their arms around and their brains around what a conventional and a conventional minus fight are going to look like in the 21st century. I always get the impression that somebody at the Pentagon may be paying attention, but nobody's letting everybody know what's going to happen historically, and this has happened since the 18th century, is that America is not going to fare well in the first parts of the war. So, for instance, in World War II, disaster at Kazarine Pass. And for the first year in the Pacific, it was hit and miss. As a matter of fact, in the first 4 months in the Pacific War, from December 1941 to March 1942, the British, the French, the Dutch, and the U.S. were all quite literally driven out of the Southwest Pacific by the Japanese centrifugal strategy. We all know about Task Force Smith in Korea. We all know about the disasters that occurred in Vietnam. We all know about that disaster that occurred in 1979 in that far-off desert in Iran that led to the creation of SOCOM. We know of that bright, shining light of 2 weeks of victory in 1991, but nothing's matched that since. Of course, that victory wasn't such a victory because in 2003, they went in and did it all over again. Please, read Dan Bolger's book, Why We Lost. He gives the play-by-play. He brings all the forensics and the receipts on why it was so poorly done, poorly executed, and everything that was done from 2001 until the withdrawal from Iraq and the other disastrous withdrawal, which should have happened 20 years ago but didn't, from Afghanistan. It's all been an unmitigated cavalcade of calamities when it comes to U.S. military power projection planet-wide in the 21st century. And I can point to many instances where that very same thing happened in the 19th and 20th century, but we'll isolate ourselves to the singular military failures of the U.S. and its allies in the 21st century. So how do you fix this? Well, I do have some suggestions. We're almost at the end of this episode, but the very first thing that has to be done is America has to stand down. It has to reassess. It has to take a knee, and it has to look at everybody responsible for all of these debacles and fire somebody. SES, flag officer, whatever the case may be. No one is held responsible for all of these failure avalanches and cascades of incompetence in all the stuff that winds together and creates these mountains of madness that create no return for America or humanity, no increased national security, not even neutral to our national security, and no ability to make sure that if men die in battle wearing the uniform, or if they happen to be supporting those in uniform, make it for a good reason. Don't make it for nothing. Let me know what you think. If you get the opportunity to leave reviews on your favorite podcast vendor, I would be obliged if you did so. I have a Substack. You can find it in the show notes. I have an email you can correspond with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That's cgpodcast@pm.me. Again, that is in the show notes. So, this is Bill, out.